5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Bazinga. Hello, everybody. Welcome back to the Now Show podcast. I'm your host, as always, Sam Houston. And I'm joined once again by my wonderful co-host, Lewis. How are you doing today, Lewis?
I'm doing well today. How are you doing?
I'm doing okay. It has been some time. We understand it has been a little longer than usual. I know we were talking about perhaps just playing it off like nothing had happened, just pretending that we'd been doing this every week. But it has been 8 months, Lewis. Eight long months. We're back. We don't know necessarily in what capacity yet. We don't want to make any promises. But this is the first episode of the new version, the new form, the new series of Now Showing, the 2024 version.
Yeah. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year. Merry Christmas.
Yeah.
I don't know what else happened. Probably quite a lot. I think the last time we did this was July with Barbenheimer. And nothing important's happened since, actually. That's why we haven't recorded, right?
Nothing of interest has come out.
If we haven't recorded an episode about it, it probably isn't worth watching.
Yeah, fact. I agree.
Yeah.
Well, so I will say about our time frame of releasing episodes is that we haven't released an episode in 8 months, and so the header of our Twitter account has been Barbie for 8 months. If we don't release another episode for 8 months, then the header for our Twitter account for 8 months will be Madam Web, and we can't have that, so we have to release one relatively soon. Why not?
We don't know. Well, see, you don't know what my opinion of Madam Web is. Maybe I do want Madam Web to be our...
Well, that's our true.
In 6 to 8 months, perhaps.
That's true, I suppose.
Yeah. So, again, we're not exactly sure of the format yet and how regularly, but when we're coming back with the Now Show podcast now, I think the idea is that we're going to be focusing more on kind of the biggest releases, stuff like June 2, perhaps, if we have time to do that for next week, and kind of the massive blockbusters, things that we're really interested in, things that give us, like, proper strong opinions, only kind of those films for the new releases, and then kind of focusing generally more week to week on doing kind of more classic films, just because, you know, it's always timeless, obviously, like, it's not going to age. And also, it kind of puts a bit less time pressure on us, because obviously we're both very busy people, hence the fact that we haven't recorded in the last 8 months. But yeah, we both apologise, that was not good enough from us, and we hope that we don't make the same mistake again. But we are back.
And
we were just so tempted by these films, weren't we? Argyle, Madam Web, they gave us real... Oh yeah, by the way, we're also doing, one, as you probably saw in the title, I'm going to be reviewing One Love, which is the new biopic about Bob Marley that released recently, starring Kingsley Benadire as the titular reggae legend. But we haven't really introduced the episode ourselves. The episode we are doing today, as we see in the title, is Argyle and Madam Web. Argyle, of course, is the spy comedy thriller that released a couple of weeks ago now, three weeks ago now. Still in cinemas, from Matthew Vaughn, the director of Kingsman, Kick-Ass, Stardust, wasn't it, as well, I think?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and some others. From the twisted mind of himself, it's kind of a story about an author who starts to get wrapped up in the world of spies, which is kind of what her books are about, and, you know, it all gets out of hand. It has an all-star cast that includes the likes of Bryce Dallas Howard, Samuel L. Jackson, John Cena, Henry Cavill, Dua Lipa, Sam Rockwell, Ariana DeBose. I might be forgetting someone if I look at the list.
Did Bryan you say Cranston. John Cena?
Yeah, I did say John Cena.
You did say John Cena.
And Chip as Alfie, Ellie's cat, according to Wikipedia.
Oh, that's lovely.
And we're also going to be looking at Madame Web, which is the newest installment in the Sony universe of Spider-Man Marvel characters, whatever it's called.
I think it's called
Spunk. Yeah, exactly. From the same universe as highlights such as Morbius and Venom, Let There Be Carnage, comes Madame Web, which is a story about a woman called, what's her first name? Cassie Webb.
Yeah.
Who she's an orphan. Her mum disappeared with spiders or something. And then when she gets in an accident, she realizes that she can actually see into time, kind of that So Raven style, slightly into the future. And using that superpower, she has to save three future superheroes from being killed by a supervillain who's gone to kill them before they inevitably kill him in the future. And yeah, it's garnered an awful lot of critical discussion, we shall say. Maybe perhaps the criticism perhaps looking towards the quality of the film, you might be able to say. But yes, so yeah, this is well, it's also, I think, partly a lot of the interest comes from the fact that Dakota Johnson is kind of distancing herself from the film during the release of it, which is impressively early, really, in the schedule. She's not kind of gone back and gone, oh, you know, it was just a quick project. She's the film hadn't even come out yet, and she was already embarrassed publicly about being
it. It was her job to promote the film, and she's been distancing herself from it.
Doesn't it wind you up a little bit, though, right? Like, she agreed. She's acting like she's better than this, right? You were not better than this when you get in the check.
Well, that's true. Like, I did see someone tweeted, and I think sums it up pretty well. They said, like, I think when you sign up to do Madam Web and film Madam Web and then get paid for Madam Web, you lose the right to act like you're above Madam Web.
Exactly. Yeah.
Which is fair enough.
Yeah. Well, clearly, I'm sure we'll discuss how Dakota Johnson rose above the source material and emerged as one of the only bright sparks in the film. Anyway, we'll get to that later, shall we? Let's start off. Well, we can't really do the news, so we'll forget about that. But we can start and talk maybe a little bit through, not every single film, of course, but maybe some of the highlights or some of the notable films that we've watched in the interim period. And obviously, as to be expected with the gap that we've had, we haven't been watching as many, neither of us really been watching as many films as we usually would have been. But I'll talk about a few that I watched. I finally got around to watching Boiling Point. That was absolutely excellent. I need to watch the TV series. That's wonderful. I'm a massive sucker for a one shot. I think it's I'm a big fan of the gimmick. Oh, Django Unchained. Yes, that saw that for the first time. I'm not very versed in the world of Tarantino. I've only seen a couple of his films. But I saw Django Unchained and I was absolutely blown away by actually just how good it is. I've heard people talking about Jamie Foxx's and Christoph Waltz's performances before and Samuel Jackson's performances before, but I've not really heard people talking about just how good the cinematography is. Absolutely exceptional.
I completely forgot that you haven't seen that before.
Yeah, I know. Kids of the Flower Moon. I'm sure if we do end up talking about the Oscars and stuff, we'll talk about that then. But obviously, Martin Scorsese's newest film, the very, very long Kids of the Flower Moon, absolutely exceptional. Absolutely loved the film. Even though it is so long, it didn't feel like it dragged. I feel like the story needed that. And just absolutely wonderful performance from Lily Gladstone and from Robert De Niro. The Killer, an even better film, The Killer. I absolutely fell in love with The Killer. I thought it was absolutely wonderful. I've always been a massive David Finch fan. One of the first kind of directors that really got me into cinema. Obviously love Fassbender as well. And I love The Smiths. And I love the time period and the art style. And it just all worked so well. But it's very funny. Very, very funny, actually. I'm very happy I got to see that in cinema rather than see it on Netflix. That was great. Rope, saw that for the first time. Alfred Hitchcock film, excellent. You recommended to me on the podcast that I'd love Rye Lane. Watched Rye Lane, absolutely loved it. Sucker for rom-coms, sucker for anything about London. Boom, tick back.
I knew you'd like that.
Yeah. And yeah, that's pretty much all the interesting stuff, I'd say. So Dream Scenario, that was the Nicolas Cage film where everyone starts dreaming about him. That went not the way I thought that was going to go. It was very much not how it was portrayed in the trailer at all. And Chicken Run 2 was great. Did you see Chicken Run 2?
I completely forgot that even came out. No, I haven't seen that.
That was great.
Apparently, though, there's a Scouse chicken in it.
Yes, yeah, there is, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, and also, I will say as well, I've told you this in real life, you know this, but from the point of the listeners. Lewis, I've just recently started trying to get back into the world of the new French Extremity.
Yes, and, you have.
Coming back to it after such a long time, I thought, well, I should probably tick off the kind of the things I need to see. So I thought, oh, I need to get through the Gaspar Noé stuff. So I started and watched Carne, which is his first film. It's about 40 minutes long. But I'd seen partially when I was in New French Extremity the first time, but I hadn't properly watched it. God, I really forgot why I would what I'd been missing with New French Extremity. The first two scenes of that film is a horse actually getting shot and you watching the horse die and the blood drain out of his head, followed by footage of a pregnancy in, you know, full frontal pregnancy. And I was like, okay, yeah, this is what the New French Extremity was. I kind of forgot what I was in for. So that was a nice reminder of the genre. But yeah, solid film. What about yourself?
I've been less active. I've not done very well at all in terms of what I've watched. But I'll talk about three things, because I haven't even been logging the films that I have been watching on Letterboxd. That's how bad I've been. I too watched Killers of the Flower Moon. Big Martin Scorsese fan. And it was great. I mean, this guy is like 83 and he's still churning out masterpieces. I think the best way, it's really, really long, and when we did Drive My Car, we said that it feels like it's about 3 hours, but it's okay that it feels that long, and that's how I feel about Killers of the Flower Moon. It feels long, but it's okay that it feels wrong. It's okay that it feels long, and the performances are very, very good. Lily Gladstone is exceptional. Robert Downey Jr. did kind of remind me of Lotso Huggingbear from Toy Story 3.
Right,
but that's not necessarily an indictment of his performance. It's just a comment on his performance. Right. He is still very good, but he just reminded me of Lotso from Toy Story 3. Yeah, it was really, really good. It's a very important story, and it was very well told. And I loved it, obviously. I have then watched two more recent films. I'll talk about two more recent films. I watched Poor Things, the oh my god, what's he called? Yorgos Lanthimos. Yeah, I watched Yorgos Lanthimos' newest film, Poor Things, with Emma Stone. And because I haven't been going to the cinema a lot, I haven't been watching films, I haven't seen any trailers either. So I have no idea. I think I saw one trailer for Poor Things about 6-7 months ago, and that's it. I had no idea what to expect going into it. And it was really, really good. It was really, really good. I remember when I first watched The Favourite, I thought that every now and again, something, like, I'll watch a film and I think, that wasn't necessarily like a masterpiece that will go down in history as one of the best films ever, but it's very much tailored towards my, like, preferences, and that's how I felt about The Favourite. I didn't feel that as much with Poor Things. It was very, very good. It wasn't excellent. I don't think it's as good as The Favourite, but it's very, very good. Emma Stone's fabulous in it. I don't think her performance is quite as decadent as a lot of people are implying it is or saying that it is. It's a very, very good performance, but it's not like she's steamrolled every other performance this year. Mark Ruffalo is weird in this film. Have you seen Poor Things?
No.
It's a very weird performance from Mark Ruffalo, and I don't mean that as in, like, the character is weird. I mean, like, Mark Ruffalo's performance is weird. In a good way. It really, really works, but it's just very bizarre. So, yeah, I loved Poor Things. It was great. And the production design and the costume design is genuinely, like, out of this world. It's absolutely phenomenal. And the last thing that I'll talk about now is The Zone of Interest, Jonathan Glazer's film, The Zone of Interest. And I had no idea what this film was about. I hadn't seen a single trailer for it. I hadn't even seen a poster for it. I had no idea what this film was about when I went to see it. I went to see it after the BAFTAs. Not after the BAFTAs. After the Oscar nominations were announced. That's what I'm thinking of. And I was like, oh, I'll go and see this film. See what it is. I had no idea what to expect going into it, and it kind of floored me. Like, if you know what it is going into it, then you'll have a very different perspective of it. But not knowing anything about it, not knowing that it's set, I didn't know it was set during World War II. I thought maybe it was a modern day film. I had no idea. And so for the first like 10 minutes or so, I was like, oh, okay, I don't really get what this is. Don't really get what's happening. And then when you kind of realize what it, the premise of the film is, the commandment of Auschwitz, living next to Auschwitz while everything is going on, that kind of hit me. The penny dropped and I was like, Jesus Christ. And for the rest of the film, I was completely floored. It was so just shocking that, you know, have you seen it yet?
No.
It does this really, like, horrible thing where it paints their lives as very normal and very, you know, just people going about their jobs. It doesn't really, you never see the inside of Auschwitz. You never see anything happen. You just see the domestic lives of this family. And if you didn't know any kind of anything about history or anything, you would just think that they were like a normal family. They never really explain anything. There's one scene where Sandra Hüller tries on a coat that's clearly been stolen from the Jews that are kept inside Auschwitz, and she's trying it on, and with no context, it's a perfectly innocent scene, but when you know what's happening, it's just, it makes you feel sick, and it's horrible. And it does this really horrible thing where throughout the entire film, in the background, you can hear screaming and gunshots and, like, furnaces. You can see smoke from the burning, and you can hear screams all the way through the film. It doesn't stop. And it's just, it's a really, really impactful film. And the ending especially, I won't spoil the ending. It's not because, obviously, it's not because of a plot reason, but the ending is particularly, like, it hits you in a very different way. And I won't go into why, but the ending really hits you. And this film just completely floored me. And I think it's a very, very, like, it's a film that will be spoken about in many years to come, because I don't think any, there have been so many films made about the Holocaust, and there have been so many films made about World War II. There's never been a film made like this. And I think it will really stand the test of time, and it will really keep coming up in conversation for the rest of time. It's genuinely a film that will stay with you. And especially going into it, having no idea what it was, I'll never forget the feeling of realizing what it was and being like, oh shit, this isn't just like a German family. This is Nazis. And it hit me like a ton of bricks, and I was like, oh my God. And yeah. It's very, very good, and I definitely recommend watching it.
Sure. Yeah, it's definitely one that I've been wanting to watch for a while, and I actually haven't managed to get time to get around to watching it, which will be the case with a lot of the films we discussed, the Oscars. I forgot to mention one thing I did watch that I absolutely, absolutely adored. I think, just judging my Letterboxd, the only thing I've given a 5-star rating between the time we recorded to now was the concept film of David Byrne's American Utopia, the Spike Lee directed concept film of David Byrne's show, Broadway show. Oh, just exceptional. If you're a fan of David Byrne or Talking Heads, absolutely give it a watch. It's excellent. It's just excellent. He's excellent. He's just such a wacky guy, and I could watch him forever. Also, Doctor Who came back. I can't be too spoilery, because obviously you haven't seen anything past series 6.
Yes.
But yes, without giving any spoilers away, as you're well aware, David Tennant came back, and as I'm sure you're now aware, then Chiwetel Ejiofor came in. I loved everything that came out. I thought it got better and better. I thought the Star Beast was great, the first episode, the first special. I thought it got even better with Wild Blue Yonder, and I thought, you know, it felt nice. I thought people acting like it something completely new and revolutionary. I think that's a bit unfair. I think there's an awful lot of stories that kind of have similar plot beats, especially kind of the isolationism and stuff. But the creatures were very interesting, and I think it was definitely a new way of doing it. And I think just like getting the dynamic between them two was wonderful. And I think the giggle was the highlight out of everything that's come out so far. I thought the giggle was wonderful. It was such a great send off. I thought it was just, yeah, everything got wrapped up quite nicely. I thought loved the toy maker and him coming back. I thought Neil Patrick Harris was absolutely excellent in that role. Yeah, massive, massive fan of that. And I thought The Church of Ruby Road, maybe not as great as the first specials, but I loved what we saw with Chewie. I can't wait to see more of him. He just seems so fun. I think Millie Gibson's great. She's giving me kind of strong Rose vibes. Again, because it's a Christmas special, it kind of had to be a bit more silly and a bit detached. You know, it couldn't be too plot heavy or anything. I understand that. I didn't like the fact that they kept on going about Davina McCall. Like, I don't understand. Like, I don't have any affiliation to her. I don't think most British people care about Davina McCall. She's not like a loved person. But anyway, other than that, Church of Ruby Road got me a thumbs up anyway, and I'm super hyped for the new series.
Sounds good. I'm excited.
Spoilers: Davina McCall's in Doctor Who.
I saw people speaking about that. And I had no idea
why. Series. Well, you'll find out in 7.5 series time.
I will, yeah.
Yeah. We watched a bit of Torchwood together. You're halfway through Children of Earth now.
I am, yes.
Yeah.
It's good.
The Oscar nominations.
Yes, they happened.
They happened. I haven't seen like most of these films, so it's not even like worth us really going into detail about it.
Yeah, neither have
but
I.
But it's worth talking about. The big things. If you missed the nominations, which I'm sure you didn't if you're listening to this podcast, the nominations for the best film, best picture is American Fiction, Anatomy of a Fall, Barbie, The Holdovers, Killer of the Flower Moon, Maestro, Oppenheimer, Past Lives, Poor Things, and Zone of Interest, of which I have so far seen three. So, you know, I'm going to have to get through them before the 10th of March.
Yeah,
so
I need a binge as well.
In the next two weeks, I'm going to watch seven of these films. That sounds quite plausible. That sounds quite easy.
That's very doable.
That's very doable. Maestro, which I haven't seen. Have you seen Maestro?
I haven't, no.
A key part of it is filmed and set in Ely Cathedral, where I live. So
oh.
That's a big deal. Yeah. I haven't seen Maestro, as neither of you, but I have seen the clip of Bradley Cooper crying about missing Leonard Bernstein, despite the fact he's never met him.
In front of his children. That is exceptional stuff. I remember someone said a few, it was the Discussing Film parody account tweeted that Bradley Cooper wants them to add a new category to the Oscars for most effort put into a motion picture.
Yeah, him and Christian Bale just fucking fighting it out.
Yeah.
That's
what Maestro seems leading the way.
Yeah. Oppenheimer leading the way in terms of nominations. 13 nominations for Oppenheimer.
Let's go.
I imagine, as I'm sure you do, that this will win Best Picture.
I assume so, yes.
Yeah, and I assume it will do very well in an awful lot of the other categories, including, I imagine, it will get easy wins and stuff like editing, cinematography. It's this year's, like, June.
Yeah, pretty much. I think... it's weird, when all of the nominations came out, I was like, I can only envision it really losing like two or three, which means we are potentially in for like a big sweep, which hasn't happened in our lifetimes, because the last big sweep was Lord of the Rings.
Yeah. Because we've seen a few things do quite well.
Yeah, I think I remember last year reading that Dune won 6, I think. I think I read that that's the most amount of Oscars that one film has won in a long time. Like, we've not had a sweep in ages. And I really do think that Oppenheimer will win a lot.
Yeah, I mean, again, it's hard for us to even get opinions because we haven't seen the films it's nominated against. But I think it is a truly exceptional film. And I think that I would be surprised if I didn't have it in kind of the top one, two, or three of every single category, because
It
is exceptional in so many different kind of facets. And yeah. But yeah, I think an awful lot of anger from the public, especially about a few things from Barbie not getting nominated. There was a large public outcry when Greta Gerwig and Margot Robbie didn't get nominated, including tweets from Hillary Clinton herself. Everyone's already heard that this counter argument, but I think it's just such a dumb argument that Margot Robbie, you know, like, it's a loss for feminism, for women, that Margot Robbie didn't get nominated when, you know, she didn't get nominated over five other women.
Yeah.
It's not like it was like, it was, you know, she, like, five blokes got nominated over. You know what I mean? It's, I guess, more of an argument with Greta Gerwig.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think that was such a strange argument. And also, I think Barbie's a well-directed film, but I don't think it was like a standout directorial performance that definitely deserves an Oscar nomination. I don't imagine that the people that are complaining have seen the four films that it got chosen over anyway.
I mean, personally, I would put Greta Gerwig in my five, but I'm not mad that she's not nominated. Because, yeah. I mean, everyone's saying that, like, they're robbed of nominations. Everyone seems to be forgetting that they are both nominated for Oscars for Barbie.
Yeah, yeah,
they
yeah.
They both are Oscar-nominated people
for Barbie. Yeah, producers, aren't they? Yeah.
Greta Gerwig's nominated for her screenplay, and Margot Robbie's nominated for Best Picture. They are both nominated for Oscars for Barbie. Yes, Greta Gerwig would be in my top five for director, but I'm not mad that she's not in there, because the other five I haven't seen. I think the only one I've not seen in director is Anatomy of a Fall. But, you know, they're all exceptional. So I'm not mad that Greta's not nominated. And yeah, Margot Robbie was great in Barbie, but she's not. She wouldn't be in my top five for Best Actress.
Yeah. 10 nominations for Killers of the Flower Moon.
That is wild, isn't it?
Yeah, so I'm happy, but I'm surprised. It feels like the kind of film that the Oscars has kind of let down in recent years.
Well, it might do what The Irishman did and what Gangs of New York did, which is get 10 nominations and no wins.
I mean, isn't there a decent chance Lily Gladstone wins Best Actress?
Yes, that's its biggest chance at a win. I don't think it's going to win anything else. And I do hope she does. And I kind of think she will, but we'll see.
Yeah. Indiana Jones and the Dial of Destiny, Oscar nominated.
Oh my God, that came out.
It's Oscar nominated.
Is it?
Yeah.
In what category? Oh, score. Is it score?
Leading actor. Yeah, score.
God, that's pathetic.
You saw that film.
I did see that film.
Did we talk about the podcast that came out after the we'd already talked about the podcast, have we?
Did we?
I can't remember. I think it was like the same time as I can't remember.
We have talked about it. Yeah, we probably have.
Okay, let's talk about these new films, shall we?
Let's.
Okay, I'll start off with Bob Marley, One Love, directed by Ronaldo Marcus Green, who directed another biopic that we reviewed in recent years, the very good King Richard, starring Will Smith, who obviously won an Oscar for that. Anyway, from him comes Bob Marley, One Love, starring Kingsley Benadire, Lashana Lynch, Michael Ward, Tossin Cole of Doctor Who fame, Michael Gandolfini, and looks at Bob Marley during a few of the most important years of his life. It kind of generally takes place in 1975, I think, until 1978, and kind of looking at his role in Jamaican politics and kind of how his music saw and to what degree it did unify the opposing political parties in the kind of civil war that was brewing and going on in Jamaica at the time. And kind of looking at Bob Marley's time in England. I thought that it was actually very good. This film has seemed to be got quite a lot of negativity. It hasn't had amazing reviews, kind of generally quite mixed. I think a lot of criticism towards him. I know that, you know, he's not a singer by nature. He's not done much singing before, and he's not an expert on reggae, but reggae or the subject. But I think he's done an absolutely exceptional job. I think he really, really shines. I think he's wonderful. I think Lashana Lynch, also really strong here. A big fan of her in other things she's been in. Obviously, the James Bond, she was 007 in one of the most recent ones. In the most recent one. But yeah, I thought that I wish there was a bit more of the actual music. Obviously, I don't know if it's a rights issue or to what extent, but there wasn't that much in terms of like seeing him in performances and finished products. You saw an awful lot of kind of him jamming and starting to kind of scribble sit down. But in the types of films these usually are, you get to see a little bit more of the kind of, you know, having the actor playing the role in terms of like finished music. I don't know if it's because Kingsley Amundiri is a singer by trade that maybe they're trying to shy away from showing him too much in terms of the kind of concerts and stuff. But I don't think I actually knew how much he actually did influence the Jamaican political situation at the time. I think I was quite in the dark on that. I don't think a lot of people know actually kind of how much he was kind of tied to ending the conflict there. But I think it really paints a great idea of a great ideal of Mali and some of his darker moments as well in terms of his relationship. He doesn't kind of pretend he's a saint or anything. It shows that his flaws as well, and some of his stubbornness perhaps. But yeah, I think it shows how much of a force music can be for good, and reggae music itself. In that respect, and yeah, I think it is great, and I don't necessarily understand where all the negativities come from. I thought it looked very good as well, so yeah, I give it like a 7/8 out of 10.
Oh, nice.
Okay, moving on. Let's talk about Argyle.
Let's.
You watched this film today. I watched it a few weeks ago when it first came out. So if you'd like to give me your thoughts. What do you think of Matthew Vaughan's spy thriller comedy? And who is Agent Argyle?
Who is Agent Argyle? That's the real question. similar to what I said, I never thought I'd compare these two films, but similar to Zone of Interest, I had no idea about anything about Argyle other than Dula Peep was in it. And Henry Cavill was in it. I didn't know that Bryce Dallas Howard was in it. Haven't seen a trailer. I went in very blind. It wasn't very good, was it? It was... it felt like an Austin Powers film. But it didn't feel like it was trying to be an Austin Powers film. It felt very much like a parody of a Spicer film. But I don't think it wanted to be that. I think it wanted to be a spy comedy thriller. But it ended up being a parody. It was very silly. A lot of the acting was very, very bad. The screenplay was really quite horrible. To spoil your thoughts on this, I think you summed it up very well when we spoke about this last week before I had seen it. When you said in the opening scene, it's set inside the book and the dialogue is really bad. And you do for a second think, oh, the joke is that she's not a good writer. Turns out, no, that's just what the film is like. And you did say that, so I'll credit you for that. But that's how I felt as well. The film is very badly written. The dialogue is horrible. And no one could deliver these lines convincingly. I didn't hate it, though. I didn't think it was horrible. I didn't think it was offensive. I just thought it was a bit, you know, I was entertained. I was entertained throughout. I wasn't particularly bored at any point. There are a lot of over-the-top twists, which is why I feel like it seems more like a parody, because it's very over-the-top, and the twists are very twisty. Nothing about it felt original. It felt like we were retreading ground that has been walked across many times before. I didn't love it. I didn't think there was nothing as well. It didn't feel like a Matthew Vaughan film. Like when you watch Kick-Ass and when you watch Kingsman, I know that's a bold statement to make from the twisted mind of Matthew Vaughan, but when you watch Kingsman, when you watch Kick-Ass, they kind of have a similar thing about them, a similar vibe. This doesn't have that. There's none of that usual flair that Matthew Vaughn, of all people, brings to the show. It really does feel like, at times it feels like an SNL sketch. It's not good. It's not good.
Yeah.
But I was entertained. I was entertained. So was it good? Maybe, because I was entertained. But I am famously often entertained by bad things,
yeah,
such as Moonfall.
Yes, yeah, true. Yeah. Argyle. Well, I will say that, yeah, that is the initial opinion I had that you just said. I was watching it, I thought, oh, you know, yeah, this is bad on purpose. This is like her writing style. This is why it looks, the you know, looks strange. This is why the dialogue is so bad. And it turned out that it just continued being like that. Then I went home and listened to Mark Kermode's review, and he said not the exact same thing, but he also was like, oh yeah, like the film, I felt something about it. It turns out it's just because it was in the book. And I was like, oh, okay, it looks like I've plagiarized my review now, because he said like a really similar thing. So I just want to clarify, guys, I thought that before Mark Kermode did. Just in case. So, you know, there's a lot of plagiarism being discussed right now with the whole James Summon thing. So I think people are on the trail. Yeah, so Argyle, I'm very much surprised by your criticism, actually. I very much disagree with you. I strongly disagree with you, Lewis.
Really?
Because you said this doesn't feel like a Matthew Vaughn film. And this feels like all of Matthew Vaughn. This is far too much for Matthew Vaughn. This, I think that, like,
oh, no,
this is just like a stylistic explosion with no substance. I mean, I think that it's graded pretty awfully.
There's no style, though.
I mean, I think, like, in terms of the production design, the costume design, the, you know, the all out, like, very over the top action, especially, like, for example, the end of the film has like very over the top action. Right, like, I think that it,
that's one way to put
yeah,
it.
Yeah, yeah. I think it feels very much like Matthew Vaughn. It feels like a bit like someone, like, you've put your tongue out and someone's poured paprika on it. It's just like a bit of an overload. Do you know what I mean? It's like, ugh, you're just spitting all out. Ugh, just too much. Ugh, get it away from me. It's, I felt like the exact opposite. I felt like this just feels like all Matthew Vaughn with no restraint. I also don't think that Matthew Vaughn's a very good writer. I don't mind Kingsman. Okay, some of those films is you know, are okay. The first Kingsman's good. I think Kick-Ass is okay. But then again, like, when you've got, like, the Kingsman, and, you know, when he's at his worst, you know, it's a little bit kind of cringy, Deadpool-y, you know. It's just a little, yeah. I'm not a massive fan of his comedic style, perhaps. And I think that his frailties in terms of his script writing are, like, at the forefront here. I think the script's absolutely awful. As I alluded to before, I was surprised that it just continued to be drivel over and over. And I will also say that the twists, there's a big twist in the film that was ruined in the announcement that I already knew about. So the big twist in the film I already knew. But the other twists felt very much, as you say, like, almost like parody, in the sense that they were just, like, so cliched, so over the top, so sudden, so unbuilt up. It felt like cliche. It felt like parody, but I think it is just bad writing, essentially. I definitely know where you're coming from in terms of it, like, looking a bit like an SNL skit. Like, I think it definitely has that vibe. And kind of not knowing where it is in terms of parody, it's almost like, they're embarrassed. He's kind of embarrassed to admit that he's trying. He's kind of like, oh, I'm just kind of half joking, like, because he wants to do all the cool spy stuff. But when it looks stupid, he doesn't want to make it like, no, I was just joking. I wasn't being serious. I was just joking. He can't, like, fully go into the whole concept of it actually being a spy film, just because in case everyone's going to turn around and start laughing at him.
That's a good way to say it, actually. Yeah.
I think that some of the performances are alright. I think Sam Rockwell is pretty good. I think Samuel Jackson's having a great time. He's just got paid a lot of money to just clap his hands and watch the world's slowest loading bar and some old basketball highlights. The CGI, though, terrible. Ooh. Absolutely terrible. Why can they just get a cat? Why do they have to, like, CGI a cat in? What, like, how bizarre is that?
It's not even like the cat was doing anything wild for most of it.
Yeah, really strange decisions. And you said you hadn't seen the trailer, you came in very much blind. I hadn't, I'd seen the trailer quite a few times. It was being played in the cinema for quite a while. So I'd already built up, seen this idea of it, and a lot of it was all the stuff that was in the book. Like, it was all about Henry Cavill and Dua Lipa, and that's what I thought the film was going to be about. On the poster, you got Henry Cavill and Dua Lipa and John Cena, and they're all in the film for about 2 minutes. Especially Dua Lipa, she's literally in the film for like 3 minutes. She's like the front center of the poster. She's like, the film builds you up to be like the female lead, the love interest or whatever.
Yeah.
And she's in it for about 2 minutes. John Cena is in it for about 2 minutes. Henry Cavill's character is in it for about 2 minutes. He keeps showing up all the time because Bryce Dallas Howard keeps seeing flashes of him.
Because he is Agent Argyle.
Because he is Agent Argyle. That's an effect. They really have to over-explain it to us. Keep doing this big blinking effect to like show it to the viewer that she's not actually... that he hasn't teleported and it's her seeing it differently and this is definitely from her perspective and like make sure you know it's from her and that's her eyes blinking. Like we don't have to be steered along the story that well, where we can understand like basic, if you're flashing over, it's not that he's teleported, that's just her seeing him. It doesn't need to be over explained over and over. It makes sense the first time, but it's like 8 times and you're still seeing this obnoxious blinking effect showing yes, this is definitely happening, she's seeing that like this.
Yeah, that was bizarre.
Yeah, not great.
You know, I am surprised that you think that this is an overload of Matthew Vaughn, because I honestly think that if you didn't tell me that this was a Matthew Vaughn film and gave me 10 guesses to guess who directed it, I would never say Matthew Vaughn.
Yeah, I think this feels quite Matthew Vaughn, and the fact that he's decided to use this as a vehicle for some sort of cinematic universe. I don't know if you stayed for the post-credit scene.
Yeah, I did. That was, it made no sense.
Yeah. I mean, I guess it's just like, that's just what you do now. If you can find a way, you will cinematic universe. Yeah. And this is now linked with Kingsman, and I don't care. I don't want to see an Argyle 2. I don't want to see a Kingsman 5 or 4 or whatever.
Yeah, no.
Yeah. Cinematic unification is just disgusting. I mean, the trailer for the Godzilla versus Kong and Ghostbusters films.
Oh God, I saw that for the first time today.
Yeah, that and Ghostbusters. Oof. Both of them. It's like, why are we doing that, guys? Just write a new film. Like, how is this Godzilla versus Kong? Is like, it's about like, oh, this is a brute force film of just like watching two fucking juggernauts slugging it out, and then like now it's their teaming up to fight a new empire that's starting inside the hollow earth. What's going on? And then Ghostbusters, it's like the grandson of one of the people from the Ghostbusters, and they're trying to shut down the Ghostbusters, and the old team are coming back, and the whole world's freezing over, and it's like, write a new film. Use your screenwriting abilities to just write an original film. Why does this need to be Ghostbusters? Why does Argyle need to link with fucking Kingsman? No one's watching that and thinking, oh, I just wish that I wish I could see Bryce Dallas Howard link up with Eggsy, or his name is Bigsy or something.
Yeah. I don't even get how it links to Kingsman, though. Like, it doesn't make sense. That it's like they've just put a scene from Kingsman in a different film. And then they're expecting us to think, oh yeah, this makes sense, they're in the same universe. But it doesn't make sense.
Yeah.
It's so strange. And there are so many things in Argyle that if we had 3 hours, I would love to get into. But there's so many things where clearly no thought was put into it. There's a scene where Bryce Dallas Howard ice skates across a room full of oil. And at one point she does a knee slide, and then the second after she does the knee slide, she has no oil on her knees. And then she shoots someone else in the head. She shoots someone in the head so powerfully that his head snaps back and he falls over. And we can clearly see that there is no bullet wound in his head on the camera. Like, I get that you can't have loads of blood and gore because it's rated whatever it's rated, but don't show us his head intact after he's been shot so powerfully that he did a 180 flip.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, no thought was put into this film. It was bizarre.
They were just too busy licensing.
But I did kind of enjoy how stupid it was.
Matthew Vaughn was just spending all his time trying to license the songs for the needle drops. He forgot to make a film.
He was, oh, yeah. Oh,
God, he likes a needle drop, doesn't he? Fuck me, every 2 seconds.
He does.
Okay, what are we rating Argyle?
I will give Argyle a 4.
Yeah, I didn't say the positives of Argyle, which there are not many. I said that the production design I thought was okay, and you know, I thought it looked fine, I guess, other than the CGI.
Yeah.
It also was also a bit too long. It really did not need to be over 2 hours. It really could have come in. And...
Yeah, there was a few sections that I could have.
But again, I thought that some of the action was fun, and like there are.
It was,
you know, it had some interesting concepts in there-ish, maybe, kind of. I thought Sam Rockwell was okay. Yeah. So I'll give it like a 3.5 out of 10.
Fair enough.
And my man of the match, I guess I'm going to say Sam Rockwell. I think Sam Rockwell was great. Well, not great. I think he was serviceable.
Oh, God, I completely forgot we did that. I haven't put any thought into who the man of the match is. I will say Bryce Dallas Howard, because I think she is... She kind of does the best she can with this, and I think she is the centre of the film, and she does quite well with it.
Yes. Okay, let's go look at the film itself. Truly a film. So, Madame Web, directed by S.J. Clarkson, written by Matt Cesarma and Burke Sharpless of Morbius fame, and starring... an ensemble cast, you might describe, of Dakota Johnson, Sydney Sweeney, Adam Scott, Emma Roberts, and a few other people. So this film is in the zeitgeist right now because it has garnered an intensely negative critical response. It's been described by a number of people on the internet as one of, if not the worst film they'd seen, worst comic book film, da 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 da. There's also been an awful lot of discussion, as we previously said, about the promotion of the film and the kind of fact that stars maybe not particularly wanting to promote the film, perhaps already ashamed of its content. And there has also been some discussion of kind of the studio system itself. I guess probably because this has got such negative reviews, people have kind of been discussing how it is as a director or as a screenwriter to be like, making a film with an organization like Sony or like Marvel or like Columbia, where, you know, at this point there's so much money going into it and so much marketing that these films are kind of being made by the board and kind of being kind of dictated by the higher ups and kind of taking away the actual creativity from the filmmakers. Like, we can't really understand to what degree that happens or to what degree that happens on each film. Like, we can't really look into what it was like to make Madame Web, but I know that, you know, prominent film reviewers. I think it was what's his name, that really big guy that did it the other day,
Chris Stuckman.
Yeah, he like opened his review up by discussing how. I mean, again, it doesn't really say very much for the film, does it? When you have to start a review by saying, "I'm not going to criticize any of the filmmakers here because it's not fair to criticize them because of the studio system." I'm not going to go down that route. You know, I mean, I understand the situation. Well, actually. When you hear my opinions, it'll make more sense. Anyway, let's talk about actual Madame Web. So, I watched Madame Web today. Let me try and remember what actually happens in this. So, Madame Web is a film about Cassandra Webb, played by Dakota Johnson. She is a paramedic in New York. Her mum was out in the Amazon looking, researching spiders, and she died giving birth to her, right? And when she was out there with the spiders, there was another bloke, and he tried to steal the spider, I think. And so, yeah, so her mum gave birth to her, and she died. But then, so we see her later on, and because something to do with a spider or something means that when she... her car fell in the ocean, she just kind of started, she saw everything, and then she was fine, she got saved, but then after that she could then see into the future, obviously, naturally. So using her powers to see the future, she ends up kind of getting into a situation where the guy that stole the spider from her mum when she died is now a supervillain that looks like Spider-Man, but we don't actually have a name for him. He just looks like Spider-Man. Spider-Man wants to kill three kids because he keeps dreaming about them, that in the future, they're going to kill him. So he goes to kill them, and then coincidentally, Madame Web, Cassie, is there, and then she sees in the future that he's going to kill them, so she tries to save them, and then he's trying to go after them, but then she's trying to, like, save them, but sometimes she sees in the future, and sometimes she, like, goes back in time, right? And, yeah, so basically that's what happens, and Sydney Sweeney is one of the three spider women. So, now we know what Madame Web's about. So,
listening to you recount the plot of Madame Web is one of the highlights of my time on this podcast.
Adam Scott is also in it, and he plays Ben Parker for some reason.
He does.
There's no explanation. So there's no explanation of why, but for some reason that's Ben Parker, and I think it's supposed to be the one that marries Marissa Tomei in the MCU.
Really?
Yeah, I think that's supposed to be her Uncle Ben, which doesn't make any sense either, of course. But they don't think about these things. Okay, so I have an issue reviewing Madame Web because I don't really believe it. I don't really believe in it as a concept. I don't think that I honestly, I'm not joking. I don't think they wanted to make a good film. I don't know why. I don't know the reasons. Okay, this is an accusation. It's all allegedly, right? If I've got any lawyers, pretend I'm joking, right? I don't know the reason why, for some sort of tax loophole or whatever, but I can't believe that Sony wanted to make a good film here. I think this has to be the creation of someone trying to make a bad film. I don't think that there is too many people must have had to watch this before it got released. That I don't believe that someone wouldn't have said that, no, we can't do it. This is terrible. I don't think that the writers were writing badly on purpose, or the directors were bad on purpose, or the actors were bad on purpose. And no offense to these people, but I feel like maybe the casting director or the person that the producers maybe brought in the people that wrote Morbius, perhaps not thinking that they were going to then suddenly write The Godfather. Like, I just think that there's something else at work here. That I think they just kind of assembled a kind of suicide squad, perhaps, of people that were not going to make a good film. Now, I think Dakota Johnson's a great actress, right? And I have no problem with Sydney Sweeney, and I think Adam Scott's good sometimes, and Emma Roberts is... Anyway, so... these aren't bad actors, necessarily, but I don't... Maybe, you know, they know that these people won't thrive in these scenarios or something, but I just don't truly believe that someone thought, yeah, this is our top guy, this is the best cinematographer we can hire. You know? I just don't... So, from that perspective, it's hard to review it, because I think it's kind of... It's succeeding. Because I don't think anyone could have passed this for checks in terms of quality control. No, like, this is easily one of the worst films. Films this bad never come out of the cinema. Films this bad are on streaming services with ads that you've never heard of, like IMDb TV or Plex or something. Like, films this bad are like... They're, like, stuck at, like, the bottom of IMDb. You've never heard of them. And, like, you can find them with Chinese subtitles on YouTube. This is, like, that bad. This is this level of shit. This makes Morbius, like, look like, I don't know, a decent Guardians film or something. It just fails on all forms of filmmaking. You can say it's for most films that are bad, I guess. The thing that comes out the most clearly is the screenplay. I've talked about old being the worst screenplay we've done in this podcast. I don't know if it is the worst screenplay I've done in this podcast. Yeah. Every bit of dialogue, maybe this was done on ChatGPT, because I don't know if humans wrote this. Everything is so... everyone talks like idiots. Everyone talks like six-year-olds that you know, never talk in real life. Everything is so clunky. All the dialogue is so clunky. I think, you know, it's not necessarily like a new idea. It's a pretty, you know, the concept of seeing into the future and the visions that she's got. It's not new, but it's interesting. There's definitely things to do to put it in interesting scenarios, and there's kind of superhero stories you can do around it, and you've got Spider-Man to play with. But the writers really, they did not at any way make the best of the stuff they were given. Everything feels like there's no tension built up, there's no story built up, everything feels that like rushed in terms of, you know, audience expectations and as we're watching, but then also the film probably feels about 20 minutes too long as well. It the pacing is completely at ends. I mean, when you first, for example, see her getting her powers when her car falls off the bridge into the water early on in the film, there is no dramatic, you know, the car is falling off, there's no like music heightening, there's no like tension, there's no like feeling that things might go wrong here. It's just suddenly it's there, everything's going fine, they get out of the car falls in the water suddenly, and then suddenly she's saved. There's no moment of tension or build up or you know, confusion or anything. It's just boom, one drop, going from story beat to the next. The pacing's off throughout. We focus far too long from really uninteresting scenarios and bits of dialogue for characters that don't particularly need it. I don't really think, for example, you need three of those Spider Women when they don't have enough personality to be shared around the three of them. You probably should have just had two of the characters. People that I think are decent actors in general, like Dakota Johnson, Sydney Sweeney, decent actors putting in all of their career worst performances. I mean, Dakota Johnson is absolutely awful here. And I think that actually it kind of devalues, like, this film, Madame Web, has to a degree devalued acting as an art form to me. Because the fact that someone that has been so, and if it was just Dakota Johnson's bad and everyone else was like decent, you could say, oh, maybe she just hated Madame Web as a concept and she thought she was above it, so she was putting in an off day. Because everyone is so much worse than they could be, you know, everyone is so bad here. You think that, like, is there actually any, like, is it hard to be an actor, or is it just having a good director? Because is it just having a good script and having a good director? Because everyone here is like worse than like the backup to a, like an EastEnders actor. It's like worse than the actors on like E17 or whatever, that EastEnders spin-off. Do you know what I mean? It's like we're talking like the worst level of, this is just bottom of the barrel stuff. And these are decent actors usually. So maybe, you know, it's all in the directing, it's all in the scripts, because we, you know, no one is, not even, it's like, oh, well, he's trying a bit harder. Maybe Adam Scott. No, Adam Scott's not any better. No one's any better. But the worst here is that it's not even below how bad, somehow getting the source material and managed to even pull it lower, I think, here, is one of the worst individual performances from any actor I've had the displeasure of seeing upon the silver screen. To Tahereh him, as Ezekiel Sims, he's the bad guy. I cannot believe that guy beat other people in auditions. There were other people they thought weren't good enough. Like, it is, oh, just absolutely just baffling. The editing is horrible. Within the first scene, when they're in the Amazon, and she's like, her mum's halfway through talking, it just gets cut to her in pain out of nowhere. It's just like the editing is out there bad in the first 5 minutes. I guess I can't say much. Oh yeah, the CG isn't good. I was going to say CG is fine. CG is bad. The CG spider is really shit. The only thing I can think of is, I just completely forgot. I haven't even talked about I watched Madame Web, but I watched Madame Web whilst trying not to fucking vomit, because I felt seasick the whole time. What was going on with the cinematography here? Absolutely awful.
Thank you.
Absolutely awful. Constant weird little camera moves for no reason, like especially in that in the opening scene when you're seeing the fight between Ezekiel and Cassie's mum, right? It's like, yeah, you're getting weird zooms in and out, like it's someone else recording, like on a handheld camera, but then you're doing like shot reverse shots, so it's not like a handheld camera because there's cuts and it's from different angles, but you're still getting zooms and ins and outs like someone's recording for like World Star. You know what I mean? That's what it looked like, someone's recording for World Star. And every you know, time we get in a shot panning from up to down on like a on a wide shot, everything is going in far too much, getting far too much movement, everything is going far too quick or far too much, everything just feels slightly queasy, everything just makes you feel ugh. Yeah, Madame Web, man, just an absolute shower of shite, just absolutely awful.
Well, what a review. That is going to go down. You know, when I think of this podcast, I think of your rant about The Conjuring 3.
Yeah, that's fair.
And that will go down with your Conjuring 3 rant as one of the best.
Thank you.
It's fair to say we have similar feelings on this film. It is... I don't think I hate it quite as much as you do. I do think it is awful. You seem to hate it a lot more than I do. I thought it was genuinely horrific, but you seem to have a lot more contempt for it. I mean, you kind of said it all. It is really fucking bad. Mm. And I do agree with you saying that I don't think anyone actually set out to make a good film, because even with, like... The thing that confused me the most about this film is that it's so obviously... like a cash grab, and it's so obviously trying to piggyback off the success of Spider-Man as a character. And I don't mean like Marvel, MCU, Spider-Man, Raimi Spider-Man, The Amazing Spider-Man. I mean like historically, Spider-Man as a character. This is clearly trying to piggyback off the success of that. But this isn't really a superhero film. There's no superhero things in it. It's more like I don't want to say this because it sounds silly, but it's more like a psychological thriller in the sense that it's not really about a superhero. It's more about a woman who starts to have visions of the future. There's no superhero elements to it. She doesn't have any big powers. She doesn't, like, there's no big fight scene. There's no big dramatic fight. There's, weirdly, and I quite liked it, I quite like this about it, there's no, like, superhero costume moment.
Yeah, true.
Why? None of them have any superhero costumes. Oh, my God. And the villain's superhero costume, or the villain's supervillain costume, you don't see properly because every single shot of it is badly lit and the camera's moving so sporadically that you can't focus on it for more than a second. So you can't notice his costume. And then no one else has a costume. Other than in visions of the future.
Oh, what about Madame Web's stupid, like, Professor X outfit at the end of the film?
That was brilliant. But there it is so bizarre. Like, why did they not have a costume? Why did they not have, like, a suiting up scene where she gets her powers? You know, I expected her to, like, go back to Peru and discover her powers and then have a costume and come back and have real master of her powers. But no, it's exactly the same. Nothing changed. Like, it's so bizarre. It doesn't feel like anyone tried to make a good film, but it also doesn't feel like a soulless cash grab, because the big things that you think of is, like, costumes. There's no superhero costumes. There's no big over-the-top fight scenes. There's just lots of dullness. It's so bizarre. It's so weird. It's such a weird film. And I was going to ask you if you think this is worse than Morbius.
Yeah, I think it's...
Because a lot of people have compared these two films together. And I don't know, to be honest. I can't remember.
I'd have to rewatch Morbius. Again, coming out of that film today, I was like, that is one of the worst films I've ever seen. That's like Monster Hunter bad. Right? Like...
Yeah.
I felt the same way about Morbius when I came out of the cinema as well. But my memory of how good Morbius is, I think there are moments I would defend and there are things I would defend. There are performances I could defend in Morbius, which I couldn't do here. If I was to defend anyone's performance, I'd probably say Sydney Sweeney is the least bad.
I would say Adam Scott is the least bad. I feel like he's doing something. The way that I felt about Dakota Fanning, Dakota Johnson. The way that I felt about Dakota Johnson is that it wasn't necessarily a bad performance. Because for me,
Samuel, let me elaborate.
It's not per se a bad performance, because for me, saying that it's a bad performance implies that it is a performance to begin with. And I don't think that it is. I don't think she's trying to be good. I don't think she's trying to be bad. She is there, upright, with awake and upright. That is all you can say about Dakota Johnson. I don't think that you can say that it's a bad performance, because I don't think you can say it's a performance. She isn't really there. She is dead behind the eyes in every single scene. It's something. It's unlike anything I've ever seen before. She has an unbelievable talent to be so detached from this in the film.
Yeah.
That you can't really say that, you know, oh, Dakota Johnson's performance was bad, because it's not a Dakota Johnson performance. It's not a performance by a human actor. You know how you said that the script feels like it was written by ChatGPT? I feel like Dakota Johnson was an AI creation in this film, because it's not a human performance. It's not like her, when she's sad, it's a bad sad. It's just, it's not sad.
Yeah, it's so funny.
When she's angry, it's not a bad angry. She's just not there. There's no human emotion
when
there.
She's trying to be
it's not a bad representation of human emotion. It's just not a representation of a human. It's so bizarre. I don't know how she's done that, but in a way, it was really like, I was so captivated by her lack of anything. She was giving nothing.
Do you know what, Lewis? Halfway through the film, I sat there and I thought, if I walked into this film, right, and I didn't know, it was nothing to do with, like, I didn't know anything about Spider-Man, it was like nothing to do with, like, the Marvel work. If this film was directed by David Lynch, do you reckon I'd like it? Like, if it was the exact same film, but it just had directed by David Lynch on the front of it, I think I'd, like, trick myself into telling me that it
was. That's such a good thing to say, Sam. Now I kind of love it.
I was like, if David Lynch did that, I'd be like, Dakota... yeah, that's genius. That's absolute genius.
Yeah. It's so genius to have a performance so unreal and unlike any human ever. It's very Lynchian.
It's when she's trying to be compassionate, that's the problem. When she's like trying to be like a mother figure for these kids, and she just does not give a fuck. Like, the dialogue she's giving, and like she's trying to be like a motherly, like she's like looking after these lost kids, and she's like, you know, like looking, you know, so she's kind of like that kind of like role model to look up to. But then she's like giving the actual energy when she's talking, like she's like a 19-year-old babysitter that's just like trying to get pocket money, and she's like looking after her neighbor's kids.
Yeah.
She doesn't really give a fuck about them. But that's what she vibes with. But like, she's actually supposed to be like caring. She's supposed to be Professor X, but for like this weird little Spider-Man.
Yeah. It's so bizarre. But like, that's what I mean. Everyone else's performance in this is bad. Like, Sydney Sweeney, I've never seen Sydney Sweeney in anything apart from, like, clips from Euphoria, but I've never seen Euphoria. I've never seen Sydney Sweeney in anything. She was horrible in this. She was really bad.
Yeah, I think
and
she was bad.
Everyone
she
else
was the least bad. She was in...
Well, I don't think so. Well, maybe, yeah. I don't know. I don't really care enough to think about that.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not going to put my effort up to
everyone. Yeah, everyone in this film, it felt like Sydney Sweeney and Adam Scott and all the other actors in this film were trying and failing. It felt like Dakota Johnson was not even trying. And that's such a fascinating thing. Like, I don't know how to describe her performance. It's not present. She's not present. It's so weird.
Oh my god.
What?
The cinematographer for... So the cinematography was absolutely awful, right? Like, horrific.
Yes, it was.
That cinematographer was the cinematographer behind the 2009 James Cameron film Avatar.
What?
Yeah, I was looking... So his name's Maro...
Oscar winner.
Mauro Fiore. And He's got
that. You're telling me that that is an Oscar winning cinematographer.
His recent few years have been rough. You know, he did a Zach Braff film last year. He did Spider-Man No Way Home, Dark Phoenix, you know, some not so great stuff, Real Steel. But he has done a few decent films, you know, Avatar and Training Day, and because Get Carter. I mean, he does slightly lose the point that I was. Oh, the obviously, yeah, the 2000. I didn't know there was a 2000 remake of Get Carter with Sylvester Stallone and Lee Roth.
That is insane. But,
yeah. I was going to say, I'll take away that.
Oscar-winning cinematographer.
Yeah. But, aside from that, I was going to say, in terms of, you know, when you're putting together this, you're Sony, you're putting together this film, if you're trying to make a good film, right, you're telling me you are getting the screenwriters of Dracula Untold, The Last Witch Hunter, Gods of Egypt, Power Rangers, and Morbius. That's their filmography, right? Matt Cezanne and Dirk Sharpless. That is the person you're getting on the phone saying, we want a script from you guys. We want this, the hierarchy of power in the Spider-Man universe has changed and Madame Web's at the top of it. We want you to write the script. After that, well, the best film in that list is probably Exodus Gods of Egypt, or it's called. That's a different film, isn't it? Exodus Gods of Egypt. No, that was... Gods of Egypt is the one with Gerard Butler in. That's like actually about the gods itself, isn't it? Yeah, that's even worse.
Oh, is it?
That's Gods and Kings of the Ridley Scott film, isn't it? Yeah, Gods of Egypt. Yeah. That's even worse. That film's terrible. Yeah. So, and the that director.
But then again,
the director.
Like you were saying.
So the directors, their career highlights include The Defenders, that Anatomy of a Scandal thing on Netflix that I talked about being shit on the podcast 2 years ago. No feature films ever. And so this is their first feature film. But so most of their stuff is like TV works, superhero films and stuff. A couple episodes of Jessica Jones. Life on Mars. You're given like a £200 million budget to that to that director. Oh, it's only an £80 million budget. I'll let him off. But still, this is not like a dream team for your superhero film. I mean, we're talking about you've got most of the Spider-Man universe to play with. Like, if you put good screenwriters, good directors, and decent money behind it, I'm sure you could have made a decent Madame Web film.
Or even like you were saying about the studio system and these films being made by committee rather than by the filmmakers. It doesn't even make sense when you think about it like that, because to me, films like No Way Home are like that. They're made by committee, and films like the X-Men films are made, or the later X-Men films are made by committee, and Venom are made by committee, and they all hit similar beats. They have big over-the-top action. They have some emotional stakes. They have costumes so that they can sell toys, and this film doesn't even have that. So it's not even like they thought, let's get a bunch of nobodies to just make this film so that we can sell
toys and get people invested
in this new character, because there's none of that. There's none of that either. It's not even like they've made a film where they've introduced this new character with a cool costume to the world, because they haven't. I don't know anything about Madame Web now. I don't know anything about her role in the Marvel Universe, because it didn't delve into any of that. There's no, like, what's the word? There's no brick building. There's no world building to flesh this character out, to turn her into an IP that can make money in the future. There's none of that either. So it's not a film made by committee, because there's no money in it. There's no like merchandise. There's no IP being built. And it's not a film being made by talented filmmakers, because it's very, very bad. So what is it? It doesn't exist. It's so bizarre.
Well, that's what I said. I don't believe in it as a concept. It's so bizarre. I refuse to believe Madame Web as a concept. It's just not real.
Yeah.
I've seen it, and it's still not real.
It's so confusing. It's so confusing.
So I'm no expert on Madame Web, right? Which I guess is a good thing.
Nor am I.
I will say what I know of Madame Web as a comic character from when I used to be into comics a few years ago is that I believe pretty much she is only ever really seen as the Madame Web that the film ends with her being, you know, in that chair and the glasses. And I think the whole idea is like she kind of can look through time and different timelines and stuff. And like she likes is a big part of like the multiverse stuff. And that's kind of her role. But that is always as a kind of character for Spider-Man to come to and talk with and stuff. And the idea of making her a central figure without being able to play that multiverse because there's nothing to go on because no one cares about the SSU, whatever it's called, the SSMU, whatever. It was always a strange decision. So it's this whole kind of thing is almost like a prequel to our usual story. But I'm looking at Wikipedia here and it's telling me that originally they were initially planned for a Madame Web kind of franchise, but it's been chucked out following the negative reaction to the film, and that their universe hangs in the balance of Kraven the Hunter, which is coming out in August, which is the next, and I'll be honest with you, almost certainly last installment in the SSSU, aside from a possible third Venom film. But yeah, I think for the state of the box office, not the box office, for the state of the multiplex, for the state of the film listings in the next few years, I think we should all pray for Kraven the Hunter to flop horrifically, because I think if that happens, they will not dare to make a SSU film that isn't Venom again.
I agree, and I don't even like Venom.
But the thing is that you don't like Venom, right? And I don't like Venom 2. I think Venom 1 was okay, right? I think Venom 1's like decent fun. Yeah. But they are like not great films. But like the gap between them and the other two films in the universe, it's insane. Like, I don't really want to go see a Venom 3. I'm not really interested. But like, at least like it's just a film that I didn't think was great compared to like these two recent SSU films that are just Morbius and Madame Web that are just like a whole different level of just shite.
It is bizarre. It really is bizarre. And even with Morbius, like we're saying, Morbius hits those beats that would typically, obviously it failed miserably, but would typically get bums in seats. Like there's, you know, big fight scenes, there's the villain and the protagonist actually have a look, they're not just people, like Morbius looks like a big scary vampire. This has none of that. It's such a bizarre film. It doesn't feel like a real film. And I honestly think, even though she is the protagonist, and you've said she gives the worst performance, I think the only person to come out of this unscathed is Dakota Johnson, because I can tell she every single day she was on set, she knew that that's bad.
Well, I understand that,
and she knew, and she didn't care.
But don't you think that when you're, and I understand that it's a little kind of contradictory in terms of kind of thoughts on the studios and capitalism and stuff, you know, should we really want them to be giving their effort into these massive corporations? But she is getting paid a ridiculous sum of money to do this, and don't you think she kind of,
she is.
And also, you know, it isn't free to go to the cinema, right? You know, it actually was free for me today because of Meerkat Movies, big up Alexander or his name is. It's not free to go to the films, especially these days. And you're talking like in California, you're paying like $23 for a fucking cinema ticket, right? I think Dakota Johnson is letting down the people that are spending money by not giving the best performance she can. And not even giving the, like, an acceptable level of performance. And I think that does kind of tarnish my opinion of her, that she's willing to just like completely turn off for a film that is going to be seen by millions of people. Like, it's going to affect her opinion, people's opinions of her. Like, could she not, like, at least tried? Like, I believe that she's a good actress, and the fact that she didn't try, I think, it makes it almost worse. Perhaps Tahar Rahim, who's Ezekiel, is, as I said, Dakota's not the worst, Tahar Rahim is. He's absolutely awful, just dreadful. I mean,
and his performance does sound like 90% of his performance, I'm convinced, is ADR. Like, it doesn't sound like it's him on set speaking.
Good way to remind me that I have a massive issue with all of the sound mixing. The sound mixing was really noticeably bad throughout. I'm not sure if you, you felt it, but like whenever they, you know, mid dialogue, say when they do constant shot reverse shot, but every time they'd flip to the other person's, you know, over the shoulder, when they flip the other person mid dialogue, they'd suddenly move all the audio from the foreground to the background mid sentence, and it would just sound horrible.
Yeah,
it's like, you know, and like for example as well. One thing I did like in the film, the two things I did like in the film, I like that she is a paramedic and she taught them CPR and they use CPR. I thought that was nice. It actually, it's nice that she remembered her job. I think that's a nice touch. Another thing I liked how she used Toxic to time her with them in the two versions of, she'd seen the universe the first time and things gone bad and Toxic was playing on the radio. So she used the Toxic to time when she was going to save the day. I thought that was nice, right? But when they walk into the diner and the music's playing, I think it wasn't Toxic, it was Scandalous, right? When Scandalous is playing,
it's
like they're walking down the hill. You can hear Scandalous from the diner in the distance. Then the next shot is them walking towards the diner with Scandalous playing as like non-diegetic music, or non-diegetic sound. Like we can just hear the music, right? It's playing over in the film. And then you walk through the door, the next scene, and then you can hear it as music in the universe in the diner. So you've just gone from between three cuts of it playing in the distance to suddenly being the music of the film to then being in the distance one after another in three cuts.
Yeah,
it's just like just schoolboy stuff.
It was really
like bad. it just little errors really like that. You think surely someone could have pointed that out. Surely it couldn't. If it was noticeable enough that Sam Houston's going to notice it on his first watch, stoned out of his brain, right? If he can get that first time, right, surely someone that's getting paid to for quality control can say, guys, do you want to check that over again, guys? Do you want to check the audio on that bit?
Yeah, that's true. And to go back to your point about Dakota Johnson and people paying money to see this film and she's not even trying, I do get what you're saying. And I do get what you're saying. And I, part of me agrees with you. Like, you're being paid millions and millions of dollars. You're being paid more money than most people will earn in their entire lives for this one film. And you can't even be bothered to try. That is, that half of me is like, that is annoying and kind of rude. But most of me is like, she knew, and we all know, that no matter how hard she tried, it would have been worse. Because her not trying is like the like I said, it's the absence of a performance. So you can't really criticize the performance because it's not a performance. And I kind of love that. And I kind of think it's great that she just said, there's no point in me trying. I'm just going to stand here awake and vertical and read the lines.
But the thing is, though, it's not even that she's just reading the lines. She's reading the lines badly. Like, the line delivery is just consistently... I think Adam Scott's line delivery is terrible as well. The line delivery is...
I don't think it is bad. I just think she's reading them as if she's reading a non-fiction book.
She's reading everything.
Like she's not delivering them badly.
She reads every line like she's kind of, like, half-interested, like, looking on her phone, and she's just, like, kind of half-talking to you, but she's too busy scrolling on Twitter to really pay attention. That's how she sounds in every scene.
Yeah.
Mate, pull your bootstraps up. It's the line
delivery. But I kind of love that she didn't try.
No. I don't vibe with that.
I kind of love that she didn't try.
Be actively bad like Tahar Rahim is.
Oh. No, I think like Jared Leto in Morbius.
My God. I've just realised that that's Tahar Rahim that was in fucking The Mauritanian.
Yes, it is.
Oh my God, I just realised it's the same guy. How can you... Oh my God, poor man. Sorry, I apologise for being so mean to you. Person who doesn't know who I exist, still a podcaster who's barely still alive. But that makes it even worse. We're talking about someone that put in an excellent performance in that film. He's wonderful in The Mauritanian.
Yeah.
And
exactly. That damages his reputation more because he was trying and he failed. Whereas so Dakota Johnson just didn't try.
So miserably.
Exactly. You're saying that he has gone from The Mauritanian, exceptional performance, great film, we both loved it, to this.
He won the Caesar Award in 2009. Dakota Johnson is not
in this film.
He won the Caesar Award in 2009 for Most Promising Actor. And I think that we should retrospectively get it taken off him.
I agree. Exactly, exactly. It's so bad. It's horrific. It's a terrible performance. Dakota Johnson is not in this film. Her face is in this film and her voice is in this film. But Dakota Johnson does not give a performance in this film. And that's why I think she comes out unscathed. Because she isn't there. She doesn't give a bad performance. It's, you're saying her line reading is bad. I don't think it is. There's no line reading to be bad. She's just speaking the lines. She's reading a book. It's the absence of a line delivery. And I think that's what makes this film so bizarre, is that the lead is so obviously unbothered. It's bizarre is what it is.
Yeah. Okay. That was Madame Web, I guess.
What's the score out of 10?
I'm going to give this a 0.5 out of 10, because I don't think I can give any...
I am going to give it a 1.
So now we've got to decide a Madame of the match, but I have no idea who the fuck to give this to, because I don't think there's a single... Actually, I'll tell you something. There is something in this film... That it wasn't good, it wasn't notable, but it wasn't actively bad. So I'm going to give it to that. I'm going to give it to the Johan Sodakvist for the score, which was not bad.
I knew you were going to do
that. It wasn't bad.
I knew you were going to do that.
Well, I can't give it to anything else, can I? The sound is actively bad. The lighting is actively bad. The cinematography is acting bad. All of the actors are different, varying levels of shit. Like, the writing is awful. The editing is awful. Like, what can I give this to? I'm going to give it to the casting director for giving me a good laugh. Like, this is all... I'm giving this to the Sony... My mad damn of the match goes to the Sony Corporation.
I... My man of the match, I haven't spoken about this for some reason. Don't know why, because it was the least important thing. But I love it in films that are set in the recent past, where every now and again something will happen where it's like a wink, wink, nudge, nudge, this is set in 2003.
Are you going to give your man of the match
to
Beyonce?
There are several moments in this. No, I'm not. I am going to give my man of the match to... Ethan Tobman, who is the production designer, for putting a giant poster of Beyonce in the film.
Yeah, that's fair.
Yeah. And for... I did... Like I say, I love the cringy, like, wink, wink, this is 2003. When Britney Spears' Toxic played and the radio host was like, oh, this new song is going to be a big hit. Oh. I love shit like that. It's so horrible.
I hate it.
And a giant. Like, and it is a giant poster of Beyonce.
Even you, the nerd, knows Britney. And they, like, grab her and pulled her up onto the stage. I was like...
I know, yeah.
I didn't say the nerd, but, like, that's her character.
Don't pretend you've not heard this song.
Yeah. So bad. Like, surely they could have picked, like, a better person to be, like, the typical nerd character. Like, she did not look like a typical nerd at all.
No, she didn't. She didn't.
Yeah. She's like...
She looked like... I don't know what the costume designer was thinking, but her skirt was really short and her socks were really high.
Oh, do you mean Sydney Sweeney?
It looked like...
She was a nerd. No, yeah, that's the thing. She looked more like a nerd.
She was the nerd.
Than the nerd. The nerd.
Well, yeah, that's
was a Lizzie Merced character who was just like a conventionally attractive.
That's true, yeah. But she was like the school. She was the one who was like bullied.
Yeah,
the nerdy one for being bullied. But I don't know what they were doing. But she looked like someone had found a really cheap, horrible, slutty schoolgirl outfit.
Yeah. Which is, I'm pretty sure, what Euphoria.
And it was
is.
Such a. Yeah. And it was just, it was not nice.
I know, yeah.
It was
grim,
not nice.
Yeah. So
Sydney Sweeney
deserved
better.
All of those girls got to be like 25 or something in real life, and they're all playing like 16-year-olds.
Yeah. It was weird.
Yeah. I said about earlier about how, like, you're setting yourself up for a fail when you write the film, you're setting yourself up for a fail when you're hiring a writer with the career that Matt Zazama and Burke Sharpless have. And I was also talking about how much they're resting on Craven the Hunter to be their next big film. And I'm looking at the filmographies of the writers for Craven the Hunter.
Oh, God.
So Richard Wenk, he is known for writing such classics as The Expendables 2, The Equalizer, The Equalizer 2, and The Equalizer 3, Jack Reacher, Never Go Back, Countdown, The Protégé, Renegades, and the 2023 film Fast Charlie. So...
Well, the future of the Spunk universe is in safe
and
hands.
Aside from those, you've also got two other writers writing it with him, Art Markham and Matt Holloway, who have written scripts for Iron Man, which is, you know, that's not bad. Punisher Warzone, Transformers The Last Knight, Men in Black International, and Uncharted. And they wrote scripts for the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles film, but their scripts weren't used.
Wow. I honestly think that Kraven the Hunter is going to be... I think it's going to be Venom bad. I don't think it's going to be Morbius or Madam Web.
I think that it'd be very, very, very impressive that they could manage to actually make three films that bad. So yeah, I think it probably will be more Venom than
yeah.
Mad stuff. Okay. We don't know what we're going to record next. We don't know when we're going to record next. We'd like to hope it's June, but, you know, we can't promise anything because we also said to everyone, we're coming back for Killers of the Flower Moon. And then we didn't. I think that's like the only tweet we've tweeted in like the last 8 months. But yeah, I mean, if you want to see our Twitter account, which is going to hopefully be more active, guys, wink, then you can follow us on Twitter at... Now Showing Pod. Do you want to say anything before I do the outro? Do you want to say that you're happy to be back or something?
Oh, I am happy to be. I'm very happy to be back. I have missed doing this, actually. I was saying in a bit that will be edited out because it was when you were making a mistake that I think I'd forgotten how to speak about films because I hadn't done this in so long. So I started listening to an old episode before we recorded and it just made me miss it more. So I am very happy to be back. And I do. We will be back soon. We will be. Let's tell ourselves that.
Yeah, I'm unfortunately going to have to cut that out as well because I don't want people to think that I make mistakes.
Oh, wow.
This is all one take. Much like Morbius. Not Morbius, sorry. Madam Web. Which felt like it was all one take, didn't it? It felt very much like it was all one take.
Yeah, it did. Cinematography was horrible.
I mean, this podcast is all one take.
But again, it felt like the cinematography was... It felt like the cinematographer was trying to do something. And it just... It was bad.
Yes. Anyway, we're
over
that.
Whereas Johnson wasn't trying to do
anything.
We're over that. We are.
Yeah. So, I'm also very happy to be back, guys. And whatever form this takes, I love doing the National Podcast. And we're going to find a way to make it more common. So,
we will.
Thank you very much for joining us on our first episode back. And as I just said about 3 minutes ago, you can find us on Twitter at Now Showing Pod. You can find me on Twitter at Sam H Media. And you can find Lewis on Twitter at, what is it?
At Lewis JWR.
And I think you can find yourself on Letterboxd, the same thing, but you're not really using your Letterboxd. I still am, and I am Sam Houston. And aside from that, I can't remember what you used to say. So if you like the podcast, give us a 5-star rating on Spotify or Apple Podcast, or tell your friends, the best way to big us up. If you want to email us, I guess you can do that at nowshamepod@gmail.com. We're thinking about maybe changing the name. We're not 100% sure, but there's another show podcast called Now Playing, and we didn't know that when we first started off. So part of us kind of wants to change, but then it's also kind of we're also kind of attached to it. So if you have any ideas on that, give us a DM or send us a message. But yeah, that's definitely a consideration. But yeah, thank you very much, guys, for listening, and we will see you next time. Adios, guys. Bye-bye.
Bye.